Welcome back to the Crick Medic Podcast, where we bring together the worlds of critical care and pre-hospital care. I'm your host, Dominic Walenzak. You know, I've been using that phrase for a while now, but I think there's no truer episode than this one, because we have with us Brandon Otto, physician assistant in an ICU, along with Tyler Christofoli, who is no stranger to the critical care EMS transport setting. In case you're wondering, no, that isn't a misprint in the title. This is part two of our discussion. Part one is over at my buddy Tyler's podcast, the Lifestar Podcast. I'll put the link down in the show notes below. In the meantime, we're going to jump right into the meat of the discussion. There are times when critically ill patients need to be shuttled from one facility to another facility to receive definitive care. Sometimes a patient is too critically ill to be transferred without additional stabilizing interventions. How stable is stable enough for transfer? Brandon, do you have an opinion on that?
This is one of those philosophical questions, I guess. What we mean when we ask it is it really going to be safe to take this person from the relatively controlled environment of a unit and put them into what we imagine as this crazy, you know, wild west of the back of an ambulance or a helicopter? And you really don't know what's going to happen, so you're sort of guessing. All you know is that people are probably going to be less prepared for it. But the dilemma is always that there's a reason you're transferring someone, whether it's just because you're generally in a low resource environment and you're really not comfortable with the patient, or there's really something specific they need and they're going to have a poor outcome without it. So you have to balance those. And I think we tend to err on the side of not sending people. If they're sick enough, we get scared and then we keep them. And sometimes that's even to their detriment if they in fact need something therapeutic that they're not going to be getting. So probably the bold thing is to weigh those risks, if necessary, pack them away, even if they are at risk to, you know, have some trouble. But I wonder if you guys have a different perspective on what that means, because you're the one who will actually have to deal with that instability. And it may be one thing for me to say, well, it's worth it, but you're going to be the one who, you know, has to deal with them crashing somewhere on the highway.
You know, it's funny. I think this kind of reminds me of the question that emergency physicians ask themselves when they ask, is this patient stable enough for surgery? Can they go to the operating room? And just like in that situation, you have to ask yourself, well, what is the alternative? Like Brandon said, if the patient needs some life-saving procedure or treatment that isn't available at that sending facility, you are it. And if they're not stable, they're probably not going to be. That's why we are critical care transport services. We're not, predicament transport services. So yes, we are going to get critically ill patients, and we might be that transport that they need to definitive treatment. So it's really not a question of, are they stable enough for transport? It's more so, what do they need and how can I make that happen?
Yeah, I think the emotional aspect is that people are more comfortable being wrong by omitting intervention, in this case, transferring a patient, than by doing something. They feel like people are going to blame them more if something bad happens. But I think the thing to take away is not that there's always a right answer, but that you should only be asking, is there anything more I can do to prepare this patient for moving them? Should we get an airway in place? Is there better access we can arrange? Can we get some better medications on board? That's a very rational question to ask. A not so rational one is just that this patient is very sick and I'm scared to do anything with them, so let's not touch them.
I have to say that I think my experience has been quite the opposite, where facilities are more quick to transfer something just to get the problem out of their ER and somewhere else. Patients who are so sick, the providers are rushing us, hurry up, get them out of the ER quick before they code, which is probably not the ideal, you know, environment for a critical care transfer, rushing people before they code in the ER where they have room and space as opposed to my ambulance. And sometimes you have to take the time to remind the providers that, no, hold on a second, there's a step that we need before we can do the transfer. Like that status seizure patient is not going to get better just because they just RSI'd them with sucks. They're still seizing. They need something else. So sometimes it's a matter of balancing what do they need now versus what can be deferred to the receiving facility. And by the same token, what exactly would be the benefit of staying behind at the facility for a little while longer? If they didn't manage the patient properly in the first place, what good is going to stay at the facility for another 10, 15, 20 minutes to do additional interventions if they didn't think of that in the first place? So in some cases, it's best just to get them out of the ER and moving towards some higher quality care.
my colleague, Sam Ireland, he's our critical care coordinator here at LifeStar. I think he says it really good because he looks at all of our critical care providers and he says, every call is a scene call. And what he means by that is you are completely reevaluating. You're starting your head-to-toe assessment, and you're looking at the patient as a whole. You don't see 911 paramedics showing up on a car accident and saying, this patient is too unstable to transport. That doesn't happen because what is the alternative? So you really got to look at each call like it's a scene call, in my opinion.
And sometimes one of those tough calls where you have to decide what's the better approach, whether it's to, you know, get some additional treatment on board or to get going towards that definitive care. Going along those lines, sometimes the definitive care, you may need to have some good IV or vascular access at some point. Brandon, I'll start off with you. What are your thoughts on sufficient access for patients, specifically like septic or bleeding patients?
I think this is actually something that does tend to be somewhat cultural. And as an example, we'll see patients who come out of the OR often, maybe a very major surgery, maybe very unstable, and they'll have like a 22-gauge IV in their earlobe and like something in their toe. And anesthesia was comfortable with that because I imagine it must just be a different environment for them. For us, I would not feel comfortable in the majority of cases moving someone into any kind of unpredictable environment who, say, is on one or more pressors and is hypotensive without them, without probably a central line, something properly placed and secured. Someone who is hypovolemic, they're actively hemorrhaging, a GI bleeder or a trauma patient, first of all, you should ask whether they need to be moved in the first place. But for me, they need large bore access, which I know there's talk of two large bore IVs, but for us, that usually means central access, which would either be a cordis introducer or a dialysis catheter used for resuscitation. In both cases, I would not be comfortable, except in the short term, using only peripherals, which would mean anything from something sketchy to even in large bore access in an EJ or something. And IOs, not so much, although I think they certainly have a role for temporizing people.
I do have to ask, what's the difference from a practical application standpoint between, like, say, an EJ and a more central vascular access? I mean, wouldn't they, in theory, be accessing the same vascular space due to lack of additional valves between that point?
The difference for me, on one hand, is that I would be more comfortable putting medications that are more of a vesicant through a central line, meaning pressors, obviously, but also things like concentrated, calcium chloride, high concentration antibiotics, things like that. But really, most importantly, is just reliability. Peripherals come out, they infiltrate, and you don't notice. I get wary sometimes about blasting, pressure-infused fluids through them. Something that wends all the way down to a reliable central vein, I, for the most part, am not going to be concerned about it. Now, not that those don't sometimes come out or do strange things, but that would be really a rarity.
And so, Tyler, what about you? What is your comfort level with peripheral IV access as far as medications like pressors and calcium goes?
I'm going to echo Brandon on this one a little bit, because I think absolutely if you're sending a patient out of an ICU on a pressor, you should have a central line. Peripheral lines, yeah, you can run pressors through them. We can do it in the pre-hospital realm, but once they're in the hospital, and even more so in the ICU, you do need to get a central line. That just makes sense. One of the things that I think is really important is that they establish an arterial line, because I want to have an invasive blood pressure. I don't want to be bouncing down the road taking non-invasive blood pressures on somebody that's on 2 to 3 pressors. It just doesn't make sense from a practical standpoint. So central line and an ART line, and I'm happy.
Yeah, some people would say that, you know, arterial lines are never essential. No one's death was ever caused by lack of an A-line. But to some extent, it's the difference between really being in control of your situation and kind of just getting by. It really gives you a close sense of the hemodynamics and your ability to really draw labs and gases and things when you need to. And in most cases, we would usually, anyone who's sick, we would drop one in.
I would imagine that the people who say that no one ever died from not having an ART line have never bounced down the back of an ambulance trying to titrate and maintain a perfusing map with a non-invasive blood pressure, because it's just not a practical thing to do. As Dominic calls it, the random number generator. It's very hard. And, you know, we're trying to defend that map, and we want to make sure we're maintaining that. And it just gets scared when you're trying to take non-invasive. So I, in my opinion, you know, this is anecdotal, but I think they definitely need to have an ART line if you've got multiple pressors going.
Now, one of the things that I think changed the dynamic over the past couple of years has been the greater advocacy for intraosseous access as one of the first-line accesses in critical patients. How does intraosseous access affect things downstream down in the OR, for instance?
I mean, we see them coming in usually from the field, occasionally the ER places one. You know, our usual rule will be that they should come out within 24 hours. But by and large, when someone comes in and we're getting them situated, as we've talked about, we'll probably end up with things like central lines and then the IOs can come out. We would only probably place them in really emergent circumstances. There's been a shift towards using them instead of doing these crash central lines on patients who code and have no access, things like that. Not really the safest practice and probably not that beneficial. But when people come in with them, I think there's a recognition that there's nothing wrong with it and it's a very acceptable thing to have, but we tend to move away from it. There's really no data on leaving them long term.
Tyler, how about you? Have you noticed hospitals shying away from pre-hospital IO access?
Yeah, they disconnect them as soon as we get there. they take them off and they put in a central line, and you know what? That's fine. It's our safety net pre-hospital. It's if we can't get a peripheral line or if we don't have time to get a peripheral line, we can put it in IO and we can put it in somebody who's conscious or unconscious. So it's nice because you have immediate vascular access available and it kind of gives you a little bit of a cushion. I think it's a bit of a cognitive offload.
One of the things that is important to keep in mind is that it'll be probably preferable to wait to discontinue the IO until you've established some sort of either greater peripheral or central access.
You would think so. You know, that I think that makes the most sense, but, you know, everybody's got their druthers, so we'll see.
I know sometimes IOs definitely can get in the way of patient positioning, especially if it's in the humeral head, you know, affects arm extension and rolling someone. But as far as patient positioning, is there any consideration between the ICU and pre-hospital realm as far as what's necessary as far as patient positioning? Supine, head up, prone?
Well, with regards to the IOs, you are actually right. We don't see as many humeral heads, but it does actually get in the way if you want to, say, run someone through the CAT scanner. They usually like to bring their arms overhead. Otherwise, you get artifact from the upper extremity bones. So that can be a little bit more of a trouble than the tibia. As far as bed position, we, in almost every case, like to have people sitting with their head up, a semi-Fowler position, you know, around 30 degrees, although you don't have to put a compass on it. It really improves outcomes by reducing ventilator-associated pneumonias and even simple things like comfort. Some people need to be flat, but I think people are left flat more often than necessary. The ER and often people coming in from the field are flat because they're on backboards and things like that. We usually sit them up as soon as we can. Obviously, people with increased ICPs in specific circumstances like that also should be flat. Occasionally, someone who's really in florid shock, you need to have them a little lower for perfusion, but generally not so much. And you're balancing, say, their hemodynamics against the pulmonary physiology. So head up whenever possible, but with the exception maybe of someone who is prone, which I don't know if it would be appropriate to transfer someone in a prone position in anything except maybe the most exceptional case. I don't know what you guys would do if anything bad happened. And I don't think I've ever done anything with someone who is left in a lateral position either.
I imagine there's also the difficulty of transferring someone from a roto bed to a standard EMS stretcher. That's probably not overly simple as far as that transfer goes.
Yeah, but a lot of places don't have them either. I mean, you can prone someone on a regular bed. But then, I mean, if someone, say, coded in the back of your ambulance, are you going to flip them over on your own? Are you going to do prone CPR? I wouldn't envy you.
And Tyler, how about you? How do you normally transfer your patients?
I agree with the heads up. I like to try to keep them at a 30 degrees, except for like what Brandon said. You know, the thought process used to be if there was a increased ICP, well, then you want their head elevated a little bit. But then I've read some recent literature saying that elevating their head actually can decrease the cerebral perfusion pressure. So it's kind of back and forth on that. And I think that keeping their heads up at around 30 degrees kind of cuts down on the ventilator-associated pneumonia. One of the patient transferring things that kind of can get a little bit hairy is when you're trying to switch them over from the hospital bed to your cot. And it seems like usually they have drips going on both sides of the bed. And I don't know if it's possible, but if you could put them all on one side of the bed, which probably is ridiculous and will never happen, then you can put your cot on the other side. And it just makes sense when you're transferring them over that you don't have all these lines that you're trying to move out of the way. You know what I'm saying?
That's a matter of where you position your pumps. I'm sure nursing probably could arrange that, but it's probably not something they're thinking about it.
Yeah, just from a logistical standpoint, you know, I walk in, I'm like, oh man, I wish this was all on this side, because now I got to try to switch these all over. And when you're trying to move the patient over from the bed to the cot, that's kind of a critical moment, because if you don't have your line set up, if you didn't calculate each move, you could end up pulling something out. You could end up pulling the tube out. So you really need to coordinate that. And what we do here at LifeStar is we practice like the first 20 minutes of an interfacility transport in our simulation lab. So we have somebody who goes around and pulls the sheet out from each corner of the bed and prepares the patient for transport. The other providers at the head getting ready to hold the tube and make sure that all stays secure. Don't take the patient off the vent and bag them to the cot. That doesn't make any sense. All of these things can be calculated and simulated way beforehand to make that transition really smooth.
I think I tend to generally do the head up. If nothing else, I mean, it's great for aspiration prophylaxis and everything like that. But from a more practical standpoint as well, we have limited space to put our equipment and all of our monitoring tools. So typically you get the head up and you put the cardiac monitor or vent down below the head, just because there's really little other place to put everything. So there's a practical standpoint of that as well. Now, when you have ventilators and all sorts of other equipment, obviously organization is key. I know a lot of ICU nurses are very particular about their lines and making sure that they are laid out neatly, and they tend to look at us with some chagrin if we start messing things around too much. One of the key things that everyone's always concerned about is making sure that the tube is secured and not dislodged. And from the pre-hospital standpoint, we tend to use the Thomas tube holder. Now, how does that differ from the ICU Thomas tube tamer, and how does it impact your ability to continue oral care and things?
Most places will have standard tube securement devices they use. It's just what is on their supply line and what they're all familiar with. To my knowledge, and I haven't, you know, delved too far through the data, no one has really proved any of them to have any significant effects on people's outcomes. It's more practical differences between them. And generally, other than small differences in how they're used, the differences between how kind of invasive they can be versus how secure they are. You can probably lock a tube to anyone's head if you tried hard enough. For instance, in burn patients, we've wired it to their teeth sometimes or to their palate. But that's sort of a bother, whereas some of these devices are much less invasive but maybe less secure. Honestly, I think one of the more secure things I've found is simply taping it, and you've probably seen that. You know, split some tape, you wrap it around, and you tape it to the head. That makes it difficult to adjust the tube is the main disadvantage. Most of the other commercial devices can be fairly secure, and some of them are fairly easy to manage, but they tend to be a little more likely to, in the long term, maybe erode part of the lips. They can chew into some of the soft tissue. In some cases, the clamping parts can damage the pilot balloon or tubing. So they all require a little bit of attention. But I think it's safe to say anything put on in the field will probably be swapped out to whatever they use there. I think it's not a bad idea if we're moving someone to think about trying to do the most secure thing, which may vary in the circumstances. I have no objection to tape, certainly. Or what some people will do is a twill tape, which you can just more wrap around the tube, and it's a little bit more adjustable.
So, Tyler, when you take a transfer, do you sometimes encounter tubes that might not necessarily be secure enough for a transport environment?
Yeah, you know, out of the ER, that happens more often. Out of the ICU, usually it's not an issue, but sometimes in the ER, they did just tape it, or they have something that's maybe not going to be secure enough for transport. And sometimes I'll swap that out with ours. We use the Thomas ET tube holder as well. And then what I do is I like to tape the ventilator circuit into several relief points onto the cot. And if you can imagine for a second, I have the tube connected to my circuit, and then I have that circuit kind of taped loosely to one part of the head of the cot, and then I'll have another spot. So if something snags on that vent circuit, it's not pulling directly on the ET tube. It's more so pulling on those several relief points that I had established. So that's just something that we do here, and I've seen other variations of it as well.
It's often hard to find an ideal way to connect the tubing from the vent circuit to the patient component. We typically don't use the inline suction device, although I think that's starting to be phased in at our service. So barring that, we typically have a lack of a right angle adapter, so it tends to kind of bend the tube. What kind of equipment do you use for your connection from the patient circuit to the vent circuit?
We have a right angle piece that's attached to all of our vent circuits. So it's kind of on a swivel. So that's really not been an issue for us. And we have the end-tidal CO2 adapter that just goes between that and the Y.
Well, I'd like to shift gears a little bit and go into some scenarios here with you folks, if you don't mind. What would be some of the differences between pre-hospital and in-hospital management of AFib with RVR? When we start off with Tyler, what's your typical treatment of AFib with RVR and your considerations thereof?
So this is kind of a checklist moment for me. So if I have a patient that is presenting to me with AFib RVR, I want to know, do they have a history of AFib? Because if they do, there's no difference between them getting tachycardic and AFib and me getting tachycardic in a sinus tach if I am in pain or if I am trying to compensate. I think we really got to ask ourselves, are they trying to compensate for something, or is this an actual electrical issue that needs to be intervened? And you can get yourself into trouble with this, because if they have a history of AFib, or even if they don't, you really got to start with the compensation approach. So you look to see, are they bleeding anywhere? Do they need fluid replacement? Are they in pain? And after I check off all of these things and make sure they're not trying to compensate, and then it's more so a Cartizem approach that we'll do. So we usually, the textbook answer is 0.25 milligrams per kilogram. What we'll tend to do is around 10 milligrams for the elderly population and then 20 milligrams for the younger population.
Well, I have to admit, I have had egg on my face before with AFib with RVR. You have a patient who presents that way, and there's no indication otherwise to suggest different pathology at play. I have ended up giving verapamil to a patient with AFib with RVR, only to find out later down the road that they were actually septic and it was more of a compensatory rate.
Yeah, the 12-lead EKG readout on our monitors identifies RVR as anything over 100. So if you get in the habit of just looking at that, you can have a rate of 102 that's saying it's RVR. And I think when we hear RVR, it may be a nomenclature thing, but we're like, wow, we got to treat that. We got to do something. So I think that you can easily get caught up in that.
Now, Brandon, how about yourself? Patients in the ICU probably have a little bit more of a history and background on them when they do present an AFib with RVR.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of thinking about it. I do think that you really need to split these people into a couple of categories. You have patients who you could sort of a primary AFib, meaning that was their presenting complaint, maybe their cardiac patients, or this is their first cardiac diagnosis. And then I think the way to go tends to be the
what the hell was
that? What was that?
Jesus, dude,
that was a little bit louder than I anticipated.
Was that a sneeze?
Let's go with that.
You might have to check your shorts.
My God.
Where was I?
Brandon, you might want to start over on that one.
Let's see. So you have a couple categories. You have the kind of primary AFibs, the cardiac patients or those who, this is maybe their first cardiac diagnosis, but it's really their presenting complaint. And those are the ones where you go through your classic AFib pathway. We would certainly, depending on how much information we already have, draw some labs, make sure their electrolytes are in line, generally do an EKG to make sure we're not missing something. But those are the ones who will respond probably best to some diltiazem, and that's what the ED I think tends to favor, versus the alternative of beta blockade such as metoprolol. Most of them I think find that it works a little better, and that's probably correct. Now, what we see probably more is people who have AFib just secondary to critical illness. There's this idea that people in the ICU tend to have increased sympathetic tone. They're under stress, there's a lot going on, and that irritates their heart. And so we see a lot of AFib post-op, post-trauma, post-sepsis, and other illness. And in that case, we tend to do more something like metoprolol. And the reasons would be, on one hand, maybe a little bit more hemodynamically stable, But on the other hand, it's really getting at the problem, which is that increased sympathetic tone. People are under that stress, and we can help to defray that directly. So we'll do a lot of, for the nuisance AFib, someone that's really not related to their problem, you can maybe give them 5 of IV metoprolol, and you could maybe repeat that a couple times. If you're not making any headway, we would probably tend to go towards amiodarone, give them the bolus of 150 over 10 minutes, put them on the 24-hour drip, and then maybe reassess. And you can always re-bolus as needed. A full amio load is usually from 5 to 10 grams, so you're not really getting anywhere near that. You don't need to be afraid of it. And as someone who actually is hemodynamically unstable, if you're not going to shock them, which of course we all, you know, maybe we should do more, but we tend to shy away from, again, the amio is often where we go to. And if need be, you can always put them on a bit of a pressor to support them for that time.
Now, what about the long-term implications of amiodarone use for AFib management?
That's a perfect question, because I think amio is kind of a dirty drug in the long term, but in the short term, it's really not. I mean, it's generally safe. People will list side effects, but they're not usually seen in the very short term. So for that immediate period, it's not a bad way to go. And then are you going to leave them on it forever? No, maybe not, and often not. But for that first hour, that first day, it's not a bad way to go. And then they can go home on something else probably, but...
Another topic that's often been hotly debated in different critical care circles is the management of ventilator dysynchrony. And there's a couple of different approaches, and I was curious to get the different perspectives of both Tyler and Brandon on this.
So you can really break this down into two different categories. The patient that is breathing asynchronously from the vent when you walk in the room, or the patient that is breathing asynchronously when you transfer them from the facility vent to your transport vent. And if it's the latter, usually it's just going back and confirming your parameters and maybe reevaluating the inspiratory flow rate, the mode, all the things that would switch that flow of ventilation from one vent to another. Now, if they are breathing asynchronously from the moment you walk in the room, then something needs to be done, whether it's analgesics, whether it is changing the settings around a little bit. I found that decreasing the eye time, and which inherently increases the inspiratory flow rate, is usually my first step. So my eyes are kind of drawn to the monitor to make sure that the tube is in the right spot and I have a good end-tidal CO2 tracing. I'm looking at pulse ox to make sure that they're not hypoxic, kind of looking at heart rate. All of these things are going through my head, and I usually am able to figure it out within the first 30 seconds.
I absolutely agree. Anytime someone looks uncomfortable or seems agitated, the first answer is not to try to shut them up. The first answer is to try to figure out why. So my first question is always, are they in pain or do they seem to be? If so, we treat that. If not, my second question is usually, are they getting along with the ventilator? And the person to point fingers at first is not the patient, but the ventilator. So you could see what you can optimize to increase their comfort. I agree. You need to make sure their flow is appropriately matched, whether they need more flow on a volume mode or on a pressure mode, it should be matching their own flow. Do they need a different rate? And in some cases, do they just need to go into a more spontaneous mode like pressure support where they can do their own thing? If you've optimized everything you can, or if the medical situation doesn't really tolerate you doing what the patient wants to do, which in some cases is just extubation, then yeah, you probably need to sedate them some. If they're on a drip such as a propofol or a benzo, then you can always turn it up. If they're on something more intermittent, a little bit of, say, midazolam is very reasonable. Sometimes we'll do some Haldol if we're trying to spare the benzos. But that's kind of my algorithm. You start with the patient, and then your last choice is blaming them.
So I just wanted to get your perspectives. You walk in, and you have a patient who's bucking the vent and who's setting off all sorts of high pressure alarms, which is therefore triggering the ventilator to cut the respirations, so you're not getting the full minute volume, so it's not alarming about the minute volume, the higher pressures. What is the first thing that you do to try and prevent some of those dangerous area pressures and the hypoventilation that's associated?
My first thing when I walk in and I see a patient, and this happens a lot, you walk in, the patient's, you know, bucking the vent, seems very uncomfortable. My eyes go immediately to the end-tidal CO2 monitor, and I make sure I have a waveform because I want to make sure that that tube is in the right place, because if it's not, that might be why they seem so upset. And then I'm going to look over at the pulse ox. I'm going to try to check my oxygenation. I'm not going to have to look at the peak pressures because I'm usually going to start hearing it from the moment I walk into the door. I'm going to look at the settings they have the patient on. Do they have them on the crash settings like we talked about in part one of this podcast? How can I improve their comfort? And I already have 100 mics of fentanyl drawn up and on my belt holster, like a bat belt, ready to go in case I need to treat their pain a little bit. Because sometimes they give Etomidate and they give Rocuronium and then they don't give anything for a little while. And the ED ICU is usually a little better with this. But that is my kind of gestalt when it comes into walking into the room. What's the first thing, second thing, third thing I'm looking at?
You stand at the bedside and you take in the three most important things, not including your nurse, which is the patient, the ventilator screen, and your overhead monitor. And usually there's a clue there, one of these things not being like the other or not fitting in. I think you can divide between the people who are uncomfortable in expressing that but are stable, and the people who have some aberration in some objective measurement, like they're desatting, their vent looks like they're not actually getting their volumes, their pressures are too high, something like that. In that case, there's a problem in your actual ABCs and you need to manage that. Otherwise, it's a question of comfort and synchrony, and you can address that in the ways we talked about.
Now, going along the same route with the ventilators, you have your patient on a vent who is now hypoxic. What's the typical first line of approach that you guys have?
So if I notice that the patient is hypoxic, I'm going to want to see if this is something that happened acutely or if this is something that's been going on for some period of time. If it's something acutely, then you're thinking things like pneumothorax, a problem with the vent circuit, did the tube come dislodged? All of these are kind of in the back of your mind. Now, if it's something that's been over a period of time or the physician tells you we just can't get their pulse ox above this marker, then I'm going to think about maybe doing recruitment maneuvers. I'm going to be checking my plateaus. I want to make sure that I'm not air trapping and kind of clamping off the pulmonary vasculature. I'm going to make sure my FiO2 and PEEP are kind of in tandem with each other. I want to see that the pulse ox is actually an adequate reading and the hands aren't freezing. So all of these are in the back of my mind when I see that pulse ox starts to drop or if it has already dropped.
Tyler, if your patient presented to you with who's intubated post-status asthmaticus, would that change your initial approach?
I think what Scott Weingart says is really good about intubating the asthmatic, that understand that after you intubated the asthmatic patient, you have not done anything to fix their pathology. Everything still exists from the tube down that was there before they were intubated. So you can't think that you don't have to do pharmacological interventions. You still need your albuterol. You still possibly need your epi. You need all of these things. And you also need to make sure you're optimizing that ID ratio. Like I said, if you're overextending those alveoli, you are clamping down on those capillaries. You're going to impair your VQ. So all of these need to be taken into consideration.
Do you end up burping the vent or disconnecting the vent for a period of time?
That's going to depend on how far into it I am. I really don't like to take them off the ventilator, but if they are crashing and I feel like they have a significant amount of air trapping, then that is an option.
In the ICU, I typically don't see as much use of the end-tidal CO2 monitoring. And those that do seem to have it built into, say, like a servo vent or what other vent du jour they happen to have in the ICU, why isn't there seemingly quite as much of an abundance of ICU end-tidal CO2 monitoring in hospital?
That's a good question, and maybe we should be using it more, and I think some places are. Some places, they have every patient on end-tidal. We don't need it as much. I mean, we draw blood gases and get reliable CO2s. The main role would be for confirming tube placement. Now, I think it's valuable for that. If you have spent a lot of time looking at vent waveforms, you can look at a screen and pretty reliably diagnose a tube that is no longer in the airway. It is probably quicker if you have an end-tidal running, but it's just one more piece of equipment. I think my approach to the hypoxic patient is probably similar to Tyler's, but it does depend on whether it's a diagnostic mystery or not. Some people have been hypoxic and you know why and you're managing it. And in that case, there's a pretty straightforward pathway you're going down. Usually it involves escalating FiO2 and PEEP, and then maybe things like paralytics and proning and ECMO and what have you. More difficult is when a person suddenly becomes hypoxic or more hypoxic, and then you have to wonder whether something different is going on. the textbook teaching is that you usually pull them off the vent and bag them. If someone is truly crashing, they've suddenly dropped their SAT to the 60s and all kinds of alarms are going off, you probably do need to do that. And that's because it eliminates a few of your problems at once. It eliminates problems with your equipment or your circuit. It gives you an idea of whether there's a compliance problem, and it gives the airway a chance to decompress in case you've been stacking breaths. The disadvantage is that it drops your PEEP and can actually cause de-recruitment, but if someone is truly that unstable, it needs to be done. If it's something that you think you can manage, then you can approach it a little more diagnostically. There's a good mnemonic called DOPES that's been floating around. I'll let you guys Google it on your own, but it covers most of the common problems. But, you know, you could run the suction catheter down and see if there's something in your way. You look at your airway pressures and see if there's signs that there could be a pneumothorax or a compliance problem. You look at your vent waveforms and see, are you actually getting these breaths in the way you think you are? In almost all cases, we would probably do a portable chest x-ray. We might draw a blood gas to see if there's other problems going on. Occasionally, we might run a bronchoscope down if we think there's something anatomical. But that would be kind of our approach. And what you're looking for is something that you're missing. Otherwise, you can always just escalate your oxygen, give them some more PEEP, but you don't want to miss a pneumothorax, for instance.
To open up to both of you, how well do you feel that an individual provider is able to feel that compliance with bagging, as opposed to, say, a more objective monitoring like one that's available on the Hamilton T1 vent, where it has the graphical representation of compliance?
You really want my opinion on this one? I think it is baloney. I do not think that. So, all right. So I'm going to go back a little bit, because there is the thought process, and I agree with Brandon. If your patient's absolutely collapsing, then yeah, the textbook thing to do is to take them off the ventilator where you're delivering precise tidal volumes and use a BVM where you're delivering tidal volumes that could go up to 900 to 1,000 cc's. But whatever, that's besides the point. Because you do need to break that, burp the circuit if they're air trapping. I get that. But the thought process that, oh, the alarm was giving me high peak pressures and it was going off, so I had to bag them for the rest of the transport. I've said this before. The BVM just doesn't have alarms. And so, yes, if you're taking them off because hemodynamically something's going on, then you do need to eliminate that variable. But if you're taking them off because you're getting pressures and you're getting alarms and you're getting different noises coming at you from the ventilator, that didn't get better with the BVM. And I think that's so important to understand, is it did not get better until the BVM comes with an alarm. People are going to continue to do that. And my opinion is that you have a better objective approach if you keep them on the ventilator and you can actually look at those pressures.
Yeah, I think that's always true if you have time to do it. The when it's more appropriate is when someone is so unstable, you need to have a go-to maneuver that is both simple, so you don't have to do too much thinking in your moment of crisis, but also covers a lot of your bases. It's just diagnostic in many respects and also therapeutic, because it's bagging is essentially a recruitment maneuver. You're giving usually much more volume than you would on the ventilator. And then get back on the vent as soon as possible so that you can get back to a more controlled approach to the patient.
One other topic that I want to discuss that as far as scenarios is hypotension. Now, it's a pretty broad category with many different branches, but I'd like to maybe focus specifically on vent strategies for the hypotensive patients, because I think that's one of the topics that's discussed by Dr. Weingart in his Hypotension Kills for intubation. So is there a specific hypotension ventilatory strategy that you choose to employ?
For me, it's driven by the physiology, and of course we have the advantage that we often know a little bit more about it by knowing the patient better. The approach to take, I think, is whatever pressure you put into the chest is going to affect your hemodynamics. The more pressure, and the way to think about it is really the mean airway pressure, the volume under the curve of the air you're putting in the chest. Higher mean airway pressures may improve your left ventricular function, meaning you're making it squeeze harder because you're putting more pressure outside the heart. But you're probably going to negatively impact your right heart function because you're going to increase the pressure around the very distensible RV, and you're going to reduce your preload. So depending on what your problem is, you may see an improvement or a deterioration as you increase these pressures. So patients who, say, have very poor systolic function, they have an EF of 10, these people often can't get off the ventilator because they need that support from the pressure you're giving them. And higher PEEPs may benefit them. That's why non-invasive ventilation or intubation works so well in the CHF patients. On the other hand, someone who is volume down, whether they're hemorrhaging or they're an under-resuscitated septic patient, those are the people who have a habit of suddenly dying when you convert their negative pressure ventilation to positive pressure. So, you know, how do you get at this? Other than having some idea of the patient's story and history, if possible, we do a lot of bedside echo. You look at how the heart is squeezing, look at the IVC and the RV. That's very helpful. And also just to expect what's going to change when you intubate the person and then have a sense for what you're going to do on the ventilator. Someone who needs higher PEEPs, for instance, they need them, but you need to know how you're going to manage it. Are they going to need more pressor to support them? Are they going to need more volume loading for that? And of course, the really challenging patients are the ones where your interests are competing. They're cardiovascular physiologists such that they're not going to tolerate a lot of airway pressure, but their lungs are in such shape that they need it anyway. And those are the people who you wish they were on ECMO, or maybe you could try proning them to improve that physiology.
Sounds like maybe a good argument for pre-hospital ultrasound.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things that is important to remember is that with each breath you give is a certain allotted amount of dead space. And that dead space is doing nothing but just increasing intrathoracic pressure. It's not aiding in a gas exchange. And so one of the common methods for a hypotensive strategy is to increase your tidal volumes and then decrease your respiratory rate. So you're decreasing the amount of dead space by getting the most out of that dead space by increasing the volume. So you're trying to calculate a certain minute volume, and you do that by exceeding your tidal volumes up a little bit and then turning your respiratory rate down. And Eric Bauer's got a really good video of this on YouTube that if you want to throw in the show notes, I think is kind of cool. Now, the caveat to that is the patient with ARDS or the patient that can't tolerate those higher volumes, then you're going to have to change that up a little bit. And I'll kind of echo what Brandon said with that.
I would tend to try to keep people on tidal volumes that I would consider lung protective. The people who I put on higher volumes are the ones with really severe acidosis who we just need to blow off some more of it. I would rarely adjust tidal volumes based on hemodynamics. And I think that that's reflected by, again, the mean airway pressure. The mean airway pressure is not so affected by the volume in each breath nearly as much as by the PEEP and also by the rate or by how long you hold a breath, which is how you end up with modes like APRV, where you just hold that breath much longer and it has the effect on oxygenation, but of course also the effect on hemodynamics.
No, I 100% agree. And I guess I'm talking more so as the traumatic car accident where they're on the ventilator and you're trying to optimize hemodynamics, not so much the septic patient, because yes, we do know that the lung protective strategies have tons of evidence to support them. So this is more so lungs are fine. They're ventilated for maybe a neuro cause. And this is where I've seen that strategy come into play. I personally have never used it, but it is one that I've read about.
Over what period of time would you say that the lung protective strategy has really become a key player as far as patient care? Over what period of time can the patient's lungs take one for the team, so to speak, with some higher volumes in the short term or interim until something can get stabilized?
That's a great question, and I think people used to assume that it was something you could leave for the eggheads in the ICU, but there's been some more recent data that even probably short periods of time with a lung injurious ventilation can negatively affect outcomes. There is one relatively recent study that looked at putting patients initially on lung protective settings in the ER and actually had a mortality benefit for them later down the road. And you could probably extrapolate that to patients in the field as well. Now, there could be other reasons for that. They did some other, you know, good practices in their ventilatory strategy. But I think it's probably not safe to say that, well, we could do whatever we want with patients for the initial period of time and they'll be okay. They may not.
So I guess sometimes the ventilatory strategy of 12 and 500 isn't necessarily always the best, depending on the patient's size.
Yeah, exactly.
Unfortunately, we're well over the time we have for this episode. Sorry to cut everyone off just when we're having fun. What can I say? It's been a gaz. Until next time, CritMedic listeners, I'd highly recommend you check out Tyler's podcast too. lots of great information contained in concise podcasts. Brandon also has a blog you can check out as well. Links for both will be down in the show notes of this episode, so check them out. And remember, as always, keep thinking differently.